Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm glad you're here. I'm the guy with a husky, sexy voice this week. I'm still trying to get some love from the women that have been on the show today, and so far I'm not getting a lot, and I think I'm going to be 0 for 3, just based on my past experience. I'm probably going to be 0 for 3 here in just a couple of seconds here, folks, so be prepared. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editor. She's an original member of our Brain Trust and one of our very good friends, and someone who I know loves me very much. Right, Joan?
Deeply.
Welcome back.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be back.
So,
how are you feeling?
Well, I feel great.
Okay.
I feel fine. My voice has just been kind of off this week.
And today I
feel like I've got a strong voice. It's just a little bit of a different. I'm calling it husky and sexy. What do you think?
No comment.
Hello. Are you there?
Gotta go.
See what I'm talking about, folks. I'm batting. Yeah. I mean, that's a full strikeout today.
You knew that was coming, though.
That's 0 for 3.
You'd have been nervous if I had said anything differently.
I wasn't surprised with Beverly Williams. I'm not surprised with you. I'm surprised at Grace Marie Turner, though. She is such a sweet person.
I am, too, yeah.
She's such a sweet person, but I didn't get any love from her either.
Wow.
So I don't know what's going on here. It's tough being a guy.
I think we all need a raise.
Man, so that's what it is. You're holding out on me, huh? Is this like the blue flu or something?
There you go, yeah.
Joan, the economy, according to the sharp, artful writing of Kiplinger, is at a fork in the road.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, remember that we started writing this lead last week, and as the week wore on, things were looking pretty grim, and then the Fed made its surprise move on Friday morning right before we went to press. So, of course, you know, everything had to be rewritten. So.
Right.
It had to be rewritten to reflect
their move was twofold,
that
right?
that the Fed lowered the discount rate by half a point.
Right. Which is not the Fed funds rate, folks. It's a different
Correct.
One. Go ahead, Joan.
Correct. It's the rate that's directly for direct lending to banks, and I'm not sure how much of that the Fed really does, but it's the raising and lowering the discount rate is really a psychological thing for the markets.
Right. All right, go ahead.
And the question is, how much will that move help the markets, whether it sort of stopped the hemorrhaging or whether problems will continue and whether the housing problems that we've been seeing will really seep into the broader economy?
Well, the other thing that they did was they injected liquidity into the marketplace. They
right.
put several billion dollars in liquidity, and as has a number of central banks around the country. I mean, around the world.
Around the world,
central
yeah.
banks
yeah.
around the
yeah.
world have. And so that I think that may have helped more than anything, Joan, to get that liquidity in there. And, of course, by lowering the discount rate, that made it a little bit more palatable for people who felt like they needed some extra liquidity. And I think it probably even gave some people, some financial institutions who didn't need the liquidity, the ability just to make sure that they had the extra.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's
now,
true.
The discount window, the discount rate, is something that's it's not as important or as big a deal to adjust it as it is to adjust the Fed funds rate. Right, Joan?
Well, I guess I just remember back in the old days when Volcker and company were raising the discount rate every time you turned around. That always seemed to send shockwaves through the markets.
Well, they were trying to tighten up on the. That's one way they can tighten up on
right.
on the people who've made bad decisions.
Right.
And because typically, it's my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, although I did sleep in a Holiday Inn Express the other day. It's my understanding, Joan, that the discount window. Is I'm gonna call it a desperation transaction, but it's it is something that if you're very, very liquid, you probably aren't going there. You probably aren't spending that money. And it's also why that rate is higher than the Fed funds rate. You pay a premium to borrow that money from the Fed. You pay a premium for that.
Right.
Whereas, because it's what, like at 5.75 now, and the Fed funds rate is 5.25.
That sounds right.
I think that's right. So anyway, the Fed injected a bunch of liquidity. That made everybody happy. So did the Bank of Japan. So did the EU, Fed, their version of the central bank, and others have done the same thing. And that seems to have helped things out. Now, the Joan, and this, you guys cover this at the very bottom here, and I want to put these two pieces together for our discussion. One of the things that I'm concerned about with the Fed doing all this is, are they helping out people who have made risky and ill-advised decisions, like some of the hedge funds? And go ahead.
Well, that's exactly what Washington is talking about right now, that if the Fed does too much to help, it's really just propping up people who were speculative and who made risky decisions. But the Fed still has, I think, a responsibility to make sure, like I said, that these problems don't bleed into the broader economy. So as we say here, they're walking a tightrope. They don't want to provide a cushion to people who don't deserve it, but at the same time, they don't want to let the economy spiral downward.
Well, that's the horns of the dilemma that the Fed almost always walks, isn't it, Joan?
They're, and
I think they call it back to there's a term, the short tail and the long tail, that they use in this case sometimes. The short tail would be adding liquidity to the market, lowering the discount rate, helping people out in the short term.
Right.
The long tail part of their job is to control the pricing, control inflation, and to make sure that the pricing doesn't get out of hand.
Right. And there have been times in the past when they've focused so much on the long term that they've ignored the short term at their peril, and created problems in the economy that way.
Well, and the point you guys are making very, very well and very correctly this week, Joan, is that the Fed has a handful of tools at their disposal, and they're using them more now than they have really in a long time. When we come back, I want to ask Joan about the impact of politicians on all this, their influence in all this. It's a little unseemly, in my opinion, and we'll do that right after these messages. It's 20 after. Joan Pride is our guest. I'll be right back. Welcome back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. My website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. That's where you can find our show, the live simulcast, the daily replay, the archives of past interviews, including all the ones we're doing today and the ones we did yesterday, and all the way back to 1999 when we started collecting these. All those are available to you, MP3 streaming, also podcasting. You can download them into your iTunes. You can burn them onto a CD. You can take them into your car and listen to them over and over again to your little heart's content. You can also subscribe to my free newsletter while you're there. You're going to like the new look, I promise you. And then we've got our blog, which we update every weekday. Thousands of articles, hundreds of Brain Trust members. And if you, you know, even my picture's there. And you know, that's the kind of thing Joan Pride goes there for every day. Right, Joan?
Excuse me? Pardon me. I was not paying attention.
And, of course, we also have our knowledge base, ladies and gentlemen, askjim.biz. That's where you can go to get your questions answered now. And both of our sites have no barrier to entry. If you can get there, we'll let you hang out with us and use them to your advantage. Joan Pride, we're talking about – Joan, by the way, folks, is with Kiplinger Editor. She's senior editor there. And we're talking about the economy and the Fed. And now, Joan, I want to talk a little bit about we're talking about whether the Fed should be seen as bailing out these hedge funds, subprime lending companies, I should say. And if some of the things that they're doing, even though they might be helping the overall economy, the short term, the short tail economy, so to speak, that action is actually helping people who've made bad mistakes. And it's a kind of, in a way, Joan, it's a little bit of a bailout, isn't it?
A little bit of what?
Of a bailout of these companies that have made mistakes.
Well, it is a little bit of a bailout, and that's why you don't want to go too far in that direction.
But the Fed is supposed to be independent, so why did Christopher Dodd, senior senator of Connecticut and presidential candidate, why did he think it was appropriate for him to summon Fed Chairman Bernanke and the Treasury.
Oh, Paulson.
Paulson, Mr. Paulson.
Secretary Paulson.
Right. Those two, Bernanke and Paulson, Dodd summoned them to his office. There was a big photo op with him. Why would he feel he needed to do that, Joan?
Well, you missed one of the points in his resume, which is he is chairman of the Senate Banking Committee.
So
he did, as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, he wanted to talk to them about what needed to be done with this credit crunch. Now, there is a lot of controversy about what he did, as you point out, because he is a presidential candidate, and one of the presidential candidates that I believe is probably at the bottom of the polling that we're seeing right now. So there has been some criticism that he used this situation to kind of bolster his candidacy.
Because there was a photo op, and a significant photo op. He made.
Right.
He also came out on his own, made a speech and all that kind of stuff. And in my opinion, Joan, and I know politics is not beanbag, but this was unseemly. It was inappropriate, as far as I'm concerned. He could have done this by phone. He could have gone to see them. I was disappointed in that, and I would say this if it were anybody, even be a good time for the president to meet directly with those guys. The Fed needs to be independent as much as possible, so anyway that's my story. Joan, let's one of the things that you guys talk about is that housing is still taking it on the chin, and it's 40% of our economy, isn't it?
Boy, it sure is. And as you've always said, housing and mortgages have so much of a ripple effect. When you think about all the construction industries that depend on them, you know, the drywall guys, the appliances, the home furnishings, everything like that.
Well, exactly. But still, Joan, what we all have to remember, there are so many fundamentals of the global economy that are solid right now. We've got record low unemployment. We've got record employment.
Right.
Meaning more jobs than we've ever had before in America. Inflation is kind of abating. Recently, Joan, as you know, oil prices came down below $70 a barrel.
Right.
The stock market is not crashing. It's actually hanging in there. Small business owners are still doing okay. There isn't, as you guys point out correctly, Joan, there isn't a credit crunch for small business owners, and I think that's on the first page, maybe another page here, but it is doing okay. Globally, Joan, the global economy is doing pretty darn well.
That's right.
For the first time, how long has it been, Joan?
It feels like since we've been doing the show.
Joan, if you think about it, if you include China and India.
Mm-hmm.
Which have never, in any previous, you know, periods, they were non-existent as industrial powerhouses, as industrial entities at all.
Right.
They're now doing pretty darn well, you know, in terms of contributing to the global economy. Europe is doing better. I think we're in an unprecedented global economic growth time, Joan.
Well, you know, let's hope that's true, because as we've said, you know, the U.S. can't carry the world economy forever. It needs a little help.
I think, Joan, in my opinion, the U.S. economy, I mean, the global economy is a strong economy, but with this credit thing and the subpar thing, I think that's like a cold. It's like my laryngitis, Joan. It's going to go away. Stand by. Quick break, 29 after. I'm Jim Blassingame. We got more to come after these messages.
Oh, I bet He's business's bad boy.
You're bad, and I like it.
Yep, he's one bad apple.
That's right, we're bad. That's right.
He's Jim Blassingame, the small business advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for hanging around with me. It's my pleasure as always. If you just tuned in, thanks for hanging out with us. If you've been listening already, a special thanks to you for that. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. I am still making some progress with my voice, but it doesn't hurt, as I said, as I've told you all week, it doesn't hurt. It just sounds a little bit differently. And Joan, you're starting to really kind of get attracted to it, aren't you?
Oh, definitely, absolutely.
Yeah. See, I told you, folks. Joan, let's move over and talk about the immigration issues that are going on. Even though the immigration bill didn't make it, there are still immigration rules that are being promulgated.
Don't get me started. Do you have a couple of hours?
I'm getting you started right now.
This kind of really bothers me. The Department of Homeland Security has published rules that say, basically, if we're going to send out letters to employers that we think or that we have found have a lot of workers where their Social Security number and other information don't match up with Social Security records, they're going to be sending out what they call no-match letters. Now, and it's not going to occur if you only have one no-match. If you have a bunch, it will happen. Mm-hmm. You'll get this letter. And that letter is going to say you have 90 days to either clear up the discrepancy, fix whatever the mistake is, or fire the worker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is supposedly a safe harbor in these rules saying that if you take what they're calling reasonable steps to verify the accuracy of this worker's information, you're going to be okay. But if you can't clear up the discrepancy and you don't fire the worker, there you could be subject to very heavy fines if DHS comes after you. Now, the problem with this is that employers are saying, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot of problems with the Social Security Administration database. We think a lot of the no-match letters we're going to get could be false in the database. So why are we being penalized for that?
False positives.
Exactly. So I think they kind of jumped the gun. I think they should have had their ducks in a row and all their databases working a little better before they went on this latest campaign.
See, this, folks, this is, Joan, this is something I've been talking about recently, and that's the difference between passing a law and promulgating the rules of that law. You know, Congress passes a law, and it sounds good on paper, but that's all it is paper at that point in time.
Right.
When it's handed down to the agencies, to, in this case, Homeland Security, to the EPA or the IRS or whatever, when it goes down to those guys, they actually get to make up how those laws manifest in our hands.
Exactly.
And those guys aren't elected. They don't answer to anybody. And they promulgate those laws. And as you can see now, Joan, they're continuing to promulgate laws. I mean, they don't just establish it and stop. I mean, they create new angles off of it every year, don't they?
That's right.
And we got certain sectors, Joan, of the marketplace that are really going to be hit hard by this. You guys point out roofers and restaurateurs, hotels.
Right.
But a lot of construction, Joan, you only mentioned roofers, but the construction industry is very much involved in people who might fit in these discrepancies.
That's right, yeah.
Bricklayers, framers, a lot of immigrants. Legal and otherwise, are in these industries, Joan.
That's right.
And so now, Joan, think about this. If home building and construction, and by the way, when we say home building, Joan, of course, we're talking about, when we say it's 40% of the economy, we're talking about all the associated industries with that.
Right.
But think about this. If they start tightening down a lot on these people, where are the construction people going to get their workers?
That's a very good question.
That's the conundrum that we have right now, isn't it?
That's right.
I heard a discussion this week with a U.S. senator, and an audience, and some pretty pragmatic, reasonable, conservative people were saying, you know, where are we going to get the workers if we send everybody back?
Right.
And the senator didn't have a good answer for it.
Well, that's the thing. You have to answer that question. You can't just blow it off and say, well, we'll figure that out later.
What he said was that we've got to decide, is the security of our nation, the sovereignty of our nation, important, or is the short-term, you know, economic situation important? And he's right. I mean, that's the dilemma. Those are the horns of the dilemma we have right now.
That's right.
Stand by. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more things like how to get through customs a little quicker, maybe, and some more about some stuff on mandatory arbitration. Stay with us. We're back. It's 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're having a great visit with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and their website, folks, is kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R, and I always like telling you about it because it's a good site, lots of good stuff there, much free information, but if you like more, you can subscribe to one of their publications, and you can get all the way back into all the deep stuff, all the way back into the site, and that is the flagship publication that Joan and I work off of every week is the Kiplinger Letter that comes every week on Friday and Monday. Friday by email, Monday in the regular mail. I get it both ways. I can't get enough of it. And then, of course, they got the three biweekly letters, the California Letter, the Tax Letter, and the Agriculture Letter every other week that you can subscribe to. They look a lot like the Kiplinger Letter, only maybe a little bit just different topics. And then, of course, they've got their personal finance magazine, the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. Right, Joan?
That's right.
And tell us, it's on newsstands, too, isn't it, Joan?
Yes, in fact, it's the only. Our other publications are all subscription only, and the magazine, Kiplinger's Personal Finance, is the one product that you can get on the newsstand.
And got a phone number, Joan?
We sure do. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
So call that number, check on the internet. You can subscribe online, by the way, to any of these publications, and they'll give you a 30-day free trial. I worked hard on that one, so check that out.
Right.
Use it to your advantage. Joan, as you know, and as I've told my audience in the past, the 1st of June, we went to Copenhagen, Denmark.
Right.
And we didn't have it wasn't a big deal clearing customs going over, but coming back, we flew through Dulles. And we literally had to get off of the airplane, get on a bus, ride over to another place, go get all of our bags as if we were checking in anew. It's a bigger ordeal than just checking into the airport. Get our bags, identify them, pull them with us, drag them all around with us, and drag them through this long customs line to basically do nothing but you know, get them, everything done. We didn't have to open anything up or anything like that. It was this huge hour-long ordeal. At least, maybe more.
Right.
And then we gave them back our bags, and we went and we got back on the bus.
Went on your way.
And then went back to the plane, and then, you know, our bags were put back on the plane, et cetera, et cetera. It's a nightmare, really.
And all that was for security's sake, right?
Well, I don't think
because you had to identify your bags and move them yourself, right?
Yeah, that's right. But I don't think it was security. I think it was just the way they do things. They want to know if you brought anything with you. You know, they ask you those questions. You're supposed to fill out a form and everything. But
right,
Joan, I think we did this before 911. It might be there may be some security element in there somewhere.
Maybe.
But Joan, if it was security, we've already landed. The damage would have been done by now.
Right. That's right.
See what I mean? So what's the news on that, though? Is there some news out there?
Well, in terms of traveling, there we say that coming soon is a way for frequent travelers to get through customs a lot faster. And this program is going to be called U.S. Pass. You have to be a registered traveler, and it lets you undergo a thorough background check, and then, of course, you also pay a fee. But that way, you get through a lot faster.
And you got JFK, Washington, Dulles, Bush Intercontinental in Houston, those are going to, you say they're going to start testing that in a few months. Joan, whatever happened to, this is good news. And let me say this, Joan, please take my money. I'm ready to give it to you. I mean,
it's going to work. It doesn't work. I don't think it pays if you only go to Europe maybe once every 5 years.
Joan, I don't care. I'll pay it.
Okay.
No, I don't go to Europe all that often. I've gone three times. I've gone 4 times in the last 10 years, so I don't go all that much. But Joan, whatever happened to the Easy Pass thing to get through airports in the United States? Whatever happened?
I think they're still working on that. I thought they were getting ready to introduce that, but there's been, I guess, a certain amount of controversy over that because it would, I guess, maybe it violates privacy laws. I don't know, but it's all completely volunteer. You don't have to go through it unless you want to.
I know, but I want to. I'm ready to go.
You're desperate to do it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, I do fly a fair amount in the United States, and it's just it's a nightmare. It's getting worse,
yeah.
Joan.
That's what it sounds like.
The lines are getting longer. I mean,
yeah.
Let me tell you something. If you go to any airport, any of any size these days, you better get there at least an hour and a half early.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we just got back. We showed up at Sacramento. 3 weeks ago, early in the morning on, what was it, Sunday?
Right.
Early Sunday morning, you know, from Sacramento. Who's coming back from Sacramento, for God's sake?
And it was
a nightmare.
How far in advance of your flight did you arrive at the airport?
We got there an hour and a half early, and I was still worried whether we were going to make it or not.
That's crazy.
And somebody there said, you should be here 2 hours. I said,
2 hours?
Who heard of that?
Yeah.
Joan, let's move down and talk. Anyway, I'm ready for that Easy Pass thing or whatever they call it, Joan. Would you please take care of that for me?
Okay, I'll work on that.
Let's move all the way down to the bottom of page 2 there, Joan, and talk about the days of mandatory arbitration contracts are numbered. What's this all about?
This is very interesting because arbitration was kind of the big thing a few years ago. To settle disputes, to try to keep disputes out of court, particularly with customers, particularly in the financial services industry. But now we're saying the days of mandatory arbitration contracts are numbered. Now, this item that we've written hasn't gotten real specific about industries, but it sounds pretty broad.
Well, and arbitration, folks, mandatory arbitration is a good deal, and it's good for everybody. But the trial lawyers don't like it. When we come back, we're going to tell you why and where this abolishing of it is coming from right after these messages and a few more things before we leave. Stay with us.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
We're back. It's 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with Joan Pride, Senior Editor with the Kipling Editors. And Joan, this mandatory arbitration thing in contracts is a good thing because what it does is mandatory arbitration. You have to go before arbitrators and work out your details, get the equities balanced in front of an arbitration, a team of arbitrators, one or two or three, I guess it is. But it's where there's a dispute, and you go and you get it resolved, and it doesn't drag on for years, somebody who deserves to be made whole gets made whole without it becoming some kind of jackpot justice. Well, guess
what,
ladies?
Both parties know going in that the arbitrator's word is final, and that there won't be any appeal, you don't have years of court battles.
Exactly. And it's good for business, it's good for everybody except the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers don't like this. Democrats are beholden to trial lawyers, and they're trying to get this thing done. And you guys point this out, Joan. You say that it's unclear about what's going to happen, that it may not actually be abolished unless Democrats win the White House in 2008.
And add some Senate seats to their majority.
Exactly.
So that's kind of an uphill battle, I think, to do all of that.
So, folks, this is arbitration. If you're a business owner, you like arbitration, I promise you. And so that's just something to think about for whatever that's worth to you. Joan, let's move on over and talk about the election cycle. Deck the halls with boughs of holly. What's this all about?
And don't forget to vote. I love this. Candidates will have to compete for attention with St. Nick. I wish I had.
This sounds so much like you.
I wish I had. what we're referring to is the fact that everybody's heard how everybody's leapfrogging each over each other backwards to get an earlier primary date, and some are now being set in early January. So the next barrier that's going to be breached is, you know, someone is going to set a primary date in December in order to be the first one.
So what this is doing, though, this is making Iowa and New Hampshire irrelevant.
Well, they're trying to stay relevant by hopscotching back over the other folks who move their primaries. That's why we think there's going to end up being primaries, that the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary could end up being in December, which means that you would have this voting occurring almost a full year before the real election.
You know, Joan, I...
Which is insane.
Back in the 60s and 70s, when I was in retail, early 70s, Christmas, we start putting Christmas out, like in, really, we'd only get serious about Christmas the day after Thanksgiving, when I first started.
Yeah.
And then it started getting set up in the mid-November, and then early November. And finally, before I left retail in the mid-70s and 75, we were putting Christmas stuff out in October. They just kept getting more, you know, more and more stuff, trying to feed off of Christmas. This presidential primary thing reminds me of that.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, the whole cycle, I think we should pass a law that says nobody can start campaigning for president officially, no debates, nothing, until January 1st of the election year.
Well, in the old days, the campaigns really didn't get going until Labor Day. You know, the people picked their nominees over the summer, and then you had about a 2.5-month campaign.
Yeah, exactly. And Joan, I do you see any of these things? Do you see a potential fight in a convention, like between Obama and Hillary or anything like that a year from now?
Well, it's possible, but
wouldn't you like to see that?
Well, it would be kind of fun to see the old-fashioned, to have a real old-fashioned convention, where it wasn't just an anointing of someone who you know is going to be the nominee, but a real fight between two or more candidates.
Well, I think that
which of course I'm too young to remember.
Exactly. No, I know you are. You've read about it in history books, though.
Right.
I think though we got a pretty good chance this year on the Republican side, at least. I could see Hillary, you know, dusting things off by the end of the year. But I think on the Republican side, we still got a chance to see a pretty good fight all through next year.
Well, now that McCain's candidacy has gone into trouble, it's really hard to see whether the front runner could be, say, Giuliani or Romney, or even if he gets into the race, former Senator Thompson.
Thompson, right, and of course we got Mr. Gingrich out there in the wings too.
Mr. Gingrich is out
still
there, that's
holding,
right.
Still holding his cards to his chest there, Joan. As it were.
That's right.
Hey, Joan, thanks for being here. Good job today.
Thank you, Jim. I hope
we'll
you feel
you
better.
Time. Thank you. I'll be fine.
Okay.
And thanks for the love too, Joan.
Anytime.
Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, reminding you to always seek excellence, not perfection.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.